You're listening to Truth News Radio on the 12th of March 2016. My name's Hereward Fenton. Welcome aboard. I've got a two-hour show lined up for you today. In the second hour, I have filmmaker Kevin P. Miller coming on to talk about his latest film, Letters from Generation RX. I've talked about this film before in previous shows, and I did a review of it about a month ago on Truth News Radio. Kevin has been on the show a couple of times before, and we've always had really interesting discussions. His films, to me, are really powerful and unique. He just has great filmmaking skill and is greatly concerned with matters of integrity in the style and the form of journalism that he's doing, so that I feel that when I watch his films, I'm getting information that has a lot of integrity. The first film, Generation RX, was an expose of a lot of the issues with psychiatric medications and particularly problems with SSRI drugs. The second film continues from where the first one left off and really goes a lot deeper into some of the subjects and has some amazing interviews with high-level people on both sides of the divide in terms of mainstream medicine about the drugs and about their efficacy. I'll be playing to you in the first hour a couple of clips from the film, and then in the second hour we'll have the extended interview with Kevin Miller. So do stay tuned for that. It's going to be a really, really interesting second hour. In the first hour, I've got a bunch of stories to run through with you. I want to look at some new information about Syria and accusations of war crimes coming from the United States, a special government panel. I've got a video clip there to play for you about that. I need to return to the subject of social engineering and cultural Marxism, which I've been touching on a lot in recent shows. I've got a couple of important stories there to bring up for you. And I've also got another woeful tale from Australia's nanny state, this in relation to the police practice of drug testing. Now, we all know about random breath testing, but drug testing now has become standard in Australia and a lot of other countries. And there are a lot of problems with drug testing, and I want to go into some of that with you in the show. But let's begin with this story that was actually covered on RT in a lot of depth. It wasn't covered in mainstream media outlets a lot. I don't think I even saw the story on the ABC Australia website. But we have US House panel, the US House Foreign Affairs Committee has passed a resolution accusing the Syrian government, Russia and Iran of war crimes and calling for an international tribunal on Syria. Now, this, of course, echoes claims that have been made going back several years, and none of which have led to anything like a real investigation or the ICCC getting involved or any of that. But the propaganda value of making these accusations is obviously still of great use to certain agencies within the US government. So let me just play to you a clip here from RT News coverage of this topic.
As the ceasefire in Syria holds, thousands of civilians have reprieved from the daily shelling and violence on the street. But over on Capitol Hill, the House Foreign Affairs Committee yesterday has passed a new resolution that may place that fragile peace in the region at risk. The resolution seeks prosecuting Russia, Iran, and the government of Syria at a UN tribunal for war crimes. The Republican-backed resolution, along with some Democrats, say that the Obama administration has shifted gears in Syria, claiming that the president has abandoned the goal of regime change, as evidenced by this new ceasefire agreement. Now, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov, they've worked countless hours through months of intricate talks to even get this far. Worth noting that this is the first time since 2011 that there has been any meaningful pause in the violence across Syria, which has reached only by cooperation of these two major world powers. And critics of this resolution say that this sort of rhetoric undermines the agreement between the U.S., Russia, Iran, and Syria. Take a listen.
Russia has cooperated with the United States and the Syria International Support Group and the Vienna process, and now in an effort to try to fight against Daesh.
I do not believe that this hostility towards Assad and towards Russia at this time, we could undermine the position of the anti-ISIL forces.
The resolution introduced by Republican congressman from New Jersey, Chris Smith, uses strong language claiming that the vast majority of Syrian civilians who have died in the conflict have been killed by the Bashar al-Assad government and its allies, specifically calling out the Russian Federation and Iran, even invoking Hezbollah as their proxy fighters. But you heard right there California Congressman Dana Rohrabacher, who's a Republican himself, arguing that Assad is helping fight ISIS, which he says is America's real enemy. Congressman Rohrabacher was quickly shut out by the rest of the floor, arguing in favor of moving forward with this prosecution. Now, you may.
Now, I think what's really important to take from this is that I neglected to mention earlier that that was actually a Republican maneuver, which is not going to lead to anything. It is a maneuver. It is a position from within the non-governmental part of Congress to try and bolster their position during an election year, probably to try to garner more votes. But what's clear from this is that the policy position of the US towards Syria and Russia really has changed, because we have here John Kerry and the leading people from the actual sitting government of the US basically knocking down these ideas and really asserting that the US now is in a kind of a partnership with Assad and with Russia. And so I think we've entered a new phase, and I've said that several times before on the show. There's still a long way to go, and I think that the situation in Syria is one that could swing the other way if a Republican president were elected. I don't think a Republican president is going to be elected in the United States. I know a lot of people believe in Trump, but I don't believe, from what I've analyzed and from what I've understood about what he stands for, that despite his massive popularity, I don't believe that it's very likely that he will actually make it to the presidency. Anyway, we'll see. I haven't studied this in great depth, though. I'm just taking a very sort of backseat position on this, looking at all the angles. I think that unfortunately, because I don't really support any of the major candidates who are running for president in the United States, but I think it to me it looks like the strongest candidate is Hillary Clinton, and it's simply from a point of view of the fact that it's probably been decided by the deciders, by the people who really control policy, that she will be the one. I don't want to go too much further into that, but what I do see happening is the hardline foreign policy positions that we've seen the US take up over the last 15 years since September 11, 2001, are being wound back. And that's a good thing. But I think that there are a lot of negative things as well. And I do fear for what's happening to American society. There's a lot to be worried about. But I think that the geopolitics, the global geopolitics, has changed to such a degree that the preeminence of the United States as this single world superpower is no longer sustainable. And that is a good thing. It's a dangerous situation, but we have to gratefully accept the positive things that we have in the world today. There is so much negative. But I think that the slow collapse of the United States as a superpower has to be regarded as a positive thing. Let's hope it's slow, though. We don't want it to happen suddenly, because that's where things could get really, really dangerous and risky. But what I see happening is this, for this to continue. I think the US dollar will continue to fade. And with that, the world will start to move towards a more balanced situation where there is really a plurality of governments and sovereignties where people can have their influence, so that the world is no longer controlled by these government corporate cartels. Because with the decline of the US government, there will also be a decline of the power of the corporations, which are largely based in the United States, which are another type of kind of global governance and power. The military-industrial complex, the pharmaceutical industry, the biotech industry. I mean, these massive corporate industries that have so much power will also tend to, well, they'll just, you know, they'll tend to break up, because the world is not meant to be controlled in this way. And when I say not meant to be, I believe it is really not our destiny to be subject to global totalitarian superpowers manipulating and interfering with governments all around the world to support the agendas of a tiny corrupt oligarchy. I just don't believe that that is our destiny. I don't think it will work. I don't think it's meant to be. And I think we are moving away from it. Now, that's about all I have to say on that topic. I've got a bunch of other things to talk about today. And I want to start with a discussion of free speech. And I want to compare free speech with something that's very common now in Australia and Western countries, which kind of goes under the umbrella of free speech, but it isn't really the same. It's this kind of elevated speech of advocacy groups that are given special entitlements by the government. You know, and in the case of the Safe Schools Coalition, they're actually invited into schools to kind of preach a viewpoint, which is essentially a type of propaganda. And we are led to believe that this is a type of free speech, whereas in fact it is actually an elevated privileged speech given to groups that are, I guess in the terms of Marcuse, as we were talking before in the subject of cultural Marxism, these are groups which are given a type of liberating tolerance. This is where certain speech is actually elevated above other types of speech. And this is what a lot of people are getting very upset about at the moment. So stay with us, and I'll continue with that when we come back from the break. Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. It's great to have you on board, and I hope that the show is meaningful to you. I hope it's providing you some new insights. If you're interested in what we do and you like what we do, take a look at the website, take a look at truthnews.com.au, and if you're not a subscriber, maybe think about becoming a subscriber. This is just a way of supporting the work that I do, and there are T-shirts that we have for subscribers. Now, we have run low on some sizes, and if you're actually a listener to this show and you've become a subscriber, there may be a delay getting the T-shirts, but I will definitely get them to you. I'm going to be putting out I'm going to actually be printing some new T-shirts very soon, and I will actually send out an email to subscribers about that, because I think there may be some people who signed up recently who did not get their T-shirt. Don't worry, I will make sure that that happens. Now, as I was saying before the break, I want to talk about this problem of free speech versus elevated privileged speech. Because that's essentially what we're seeing in the problem with the Safe Schools Coalition and government-funded programs that are being placed in schools, where our children are being forcibly educated about certain socio-political realities in the guise of general education. And I'm calling it socio-political realities because when you talk about things like cross-dressing, you know, there's not a lot of strict science that is available to prove that, say, someone who decides to transition to another gender, or someone who just decides they want to dress up as a different gender, that that is actually, in any sense, a biological reality. I know there are people who will claim that, but it's an incredibly unclear area of science. And in many cases, the people who are becoming transsexual or just cross-dressing or going through the full surgical transition, they are not clear themselves 100% where they stand in the spectrum between male and female. And a lot of them are shifting one way and then shifting the other way, and then some are going into this kind of intermediate space called intersex. So I'm aware that there is a lobby that says that being gay is something you're born with, it's somehow sort of programmed into you. But clearly there's a lot of people who are advocating this wider kind of area of sexuality or gender that are saying, actually, no, it's totally fluid. And there it actually does become a question of politics and society and societal norms and what we consider to be acceptable or not according to the morality that we follow. You see, there's an important distinction to make between saying that something is, you know, scientifically proven as opposed to saying, well, this is something that we, you know, culturally support. And just let me give you an example of something that is scientifically proven. Black people and white people are the same species. That is scientifically proven. And when I say scientifically, what is the criteria? You probably should ask, what is the criteria? Well, the criteria is for someone, for two instances of a creature to be considered the same species, they need to be able to breed together. And white people and black people can breed together quite happily. There is no problem at all. So white, black, Chinese, we are all the same species. We are all the same genera. So we are the same people. And racial arguments, which were very, very common 100 years ago, have been disproven through science. But when we talk about gay people, or when we talk about people who cross-dress or who become transsexual, there is, what I'm trying to demonstrate is that the distinction between whether this is a choice and a lifestyle choice, as opposed to whether this is somehow an involuntary biological reality, has yet to be proven, and I don't believe it will ever be proven. And that's fine, because you know what? We can accept people who are different, and we should accept people who are different, who choose different lifestyles, as long as they're not hurting another person, as long as they're engaging in consensual activities, then there is no problem. But does that mean we should be endorsing advocacy, which is essentially political advocacy, of these people who have different lifestyle choices to become a rigid part of the kind of curriculum which is taught within schools? And this is not a question of free speech anymore. This is a question of co-opted privileged speech that is being introduced into our society, and it's coming a lot through academic channels, which are then being fed into the advisory bodies that say, well, you know, this is something we want to have in the school. Now, there is another problem which arises out of this. When the people who protest against this are themselves accused of being bigoted and oppressive because they disagree with the right of free speech granted to those people who go into schools and have public platforms to talk about this information. And in a sense, it's to be expected that those who've been granted these special privileges would feel that any questioning of that was a type of oppression against them. And it gets more complicated than that, because some of these people who are speaking out, and I've been keeping track of the kind of the dissident voices in Australia who are questioning trends which we just might put under the umbrella of cultural Marxism in Australia, that they tend to fall into a very tight political spectrum of people who have views that you could only call extreme right-wing views. And I don't like using those labels myself, but some of the people, and I'll just give you a few names of people that have popped up. There's a chap by the name of Bill Muhlenberg. There's, of course, Larry Pickering, who we all know from that he's a cartoonist. There's a chap by the name of Bernard Gaynor, and a lady by the name of Christine Sind. And a lot of these people have spoken out against an agenda within society to promote LGBTI issues to what they consider to be an excessive extent, and that these people are that these advocacies are given far too much power, and as we've seen, as I raised in previous shows, this has actually come up in Parliament, where an MP and a senator have actually spoken out against this as well, and there is a lot of broad public agreement that this isn't right, that these things shouldn't be happening. But the problem is that some of these people, the individuals I've named, are also tied to views that I myself abhor. Because all the people I just mentioned, the names that I just mentioned, they are all on the bandwagon of very, very harsh criticism of Islam, to the extent of wanting to ban mosques, wanting to prevent Muslims from being able to migrate to Australia. And they take the position that there is a kind of a war between Islam and the West. Some of these people are Christian, and there's a clash of civilizations angle to this that they are firmly adopting. And I'll continue with that when we come back, because it's a very, very important point. We'll be right back. Welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio. So as I was saying there before the break, we have a conflict within Australian society, which is mirrored in other countries, where you have an excessive government bureaucracy with political objectives from left-wing progressives that has become very, very dominant and is now going into schools and has become very, very prominent propaganda that is empowered by both government and corporate media, which is a type of social engineering, which seems like it has gone way too far, that the pendulum has swung way too far the other way. I mean, of course, in the days when gay people were afraid of being beaten up, when there was massive prejudice against gay people, you could say that the pendulum was the other way. But now, with all of this new legislation that's come in, it really appears that things have just gone way, way too far and have created a new type of oppression. And it really is an oppression of people who belong to traditional viewpoints, because people who have a traditional view of gender or marriage are being regarded, and this is really coming from an academic perspective, are being regarded as if they are a threat to society, as if they are somehow bad people that we have to kind of, the good people have to defend themselves against. And because they are being given this label of being bad, it opens the door to all kinds of legislative measures which might be used to suppress them and ultimately to imprison them. I mean, this is an inevitable consequence when you get this type of approach to a social problem tied with excessive government powers. Now, on the other hand, we have a burgeoning hardline right-wing position, which is characterized by people who represent very traditional views of marriage and gender and are often Christian. And their views about gender and marriage and sexuality are tied together because of their traditional perspective as well about religion, are tied with their great animosity towards Islam. And unfortunately, this has just created an impossible situation for people who want to be able to have to express their point of view freely without being tied in or lumped in to these pigeonholes. And I've striven quite hard on the show to distinguish myself from these groupings. I've talked a lot about Islam on this show, and I'm going to continue doing so. There is a problem with radical Islam. It's well accepted and it's well acknowledged. And I think what Tony Abbott said, where he said that that some sort of reformation within Islam is possibly overdue, I think I agree with that. But the people who are taking the extreme positions go way, way further than that. They're not tolerant at all. They basically have taken an extremist us versus them clash of civilizations position, which I think is reprehensible, and I think these people are reprehensible for doing it. Now, unfortunately, because these people are also tied with some of the major critiques of the cultural Marxist practices that are going on in our society, by supporting some of those views, I run the risk of being seen as supporting their other views, which I don't. I'm completely independent. I'm an independent thinker, and this is what we need more of in our society. We need more independent thinkers. Now, I want to just proceed by actually talking about some of the issues. A couple of new stories here. Toddlers to be taught about cross-dressing in controversial sex ed program. And I do have an article here from the Herald Sun, which I think is mainstream enough that I can quote it on here without being, you know, regarded as being too controversial. And this is from March the 5th, 2016. Toddlers will be taught about sex, sexuality and cross-dressing in a controversial national program being rolled out at childcare centres and kindergartens next month. Educators will be encouraged to use dress-ups to explain cross-dressing to kids and may even take group tours of the opposite sex's toilets as part of the Start Early initiative. Teachers will use material provided by Early Childhood Australia and books such as the book Children's Sexual Development and Behaviour by Pam Link. Suggestions in the book include teaching about sexuality in a positive way as a healthy part of life, ensuring children aren't forced to kiss anyone they don't want to, and letting children know that all parts of their body are good. Early Childhood Australia spokeswoman Claire McHugh said the program would reduce domestic violence because rigid views on gender were associated with violence and domestic violence. Children are sexual beings, and it's a strong part of their identity, and it is linked to their values and respect, she said. Now, this statement that children are sexual beings has been construed as being very controversial, and of course the traditionalists are greatly opposed to this view, and indeed it is controversial. It was a view that was widely held in the 1970s, and it is somewhat a left-wing progressive point of view. The more traditional view about this is that sexuality is something that children should not be overly exposed to, that we shouldn't be putting too much attention on it. We let children develop as children and wait till after puberty to kind of give them information and extra education about sexuality. Well, the left progressive argument has sort of been to kind of focus on sexuality at a much earlier stage of life. And along with that, things like gender. Now, there's been a big reaction against this, but some of the people who are leading this are people who do have ways of expressing themselves that are very, very harsh. And I'm hesitant to even link to some of the material here. There's a guy by the name of Bill Muhlenberg, who I believe is an American expat living in Australia. And he said some very, very harsh things. He's also been criticised for his Islamophobic positions as well in the past. And some of his writings have been accused of being libelous. So I'm not actually going to link directly to Bill Muhlenberg. And unfortunately, that's the situation we've got. Because the free speech of people like this is not at all supported in Australia anymore. The free speech of people such as the ones promoting these programs is fully supported and has the full backing of the government. But the people who have positions against those people, the people who come from traditionalist positions, are only barely tolerated at best within mainstream Australian society. Bill Muhlenberg has, in recent blog posts, quoted from a journal, the Australian Journal of Early Childhood, and he's quoted from some of their academic writings to illustrate what he sees as being this this highly political, propagandistic angle being fed into policy as an academic position. And just a quote here from one, this is actually a quote from the AJEC, which Muhlenberg has singled out for special attention. This special edition of AGAEC is one small opening to troubling normalised practices in early childhood, enabling often silenced conversations located on the borders to enter the mainstream. We hope that, through engaging with the articles, early childhood education moves one step closer to becoming a site of inclusion, hope and possibility for all. And I'll just continue that with that when we come from the break. You are with Truth News Radio Australia. Stay with us.
happens in terms of creating wars is a mind manipulation technique called problem reaction solution. And it works like this. First of all, you create the problem, but you get someone else to be blamed for it. You then report that problem through the media in the way you want it reported. You get the public to react to your problem by saying something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it?
Hi, welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio. And I'm just going to read you here another quote from the Australian Journal of Early Childhood. Early childhood educators can play a critical role in providing young children with a supportive environment in which they can express and explore different performances of gender, including those that sit outside heteronormative socio-cultural norms. Supportive adults and an inclusive learning environment are highly significant to the health and well-being of young children who choose to take up non-normative performances of gender. Such a flexible and supportive environment is also important for all children, including those who conform to gender norms. This sends a strong message to children about appreciating diversity and difference rather than fearing it, and it validates children's choices to do gender differently if they so wish. Now, that is quite a mouthful of gobbledygook. The term heteronormative is used a lot now in these academic discussions, and it is a type of pejorative term. Heteronormative really is an accusation that heterosexual people are sort of normalizing society, forcing children into a normalized heterosexual perspective and not allowing them that freedom to be different, to be different. So the main problem that I believe with this is that this really is under the radar political propagandizing. Because you see, if you're deciding to send messages to children about appreciating diversity, you're not sort of allowing them to develop their own views. You're co-opting and pushing them in a certain direction. You're not just saying allow diversity, you're saying try this, you know. You're actually suggesting to them that they should try cross-dressing. And that's indeed what this program appears to be doing, and that was from the Herald Sun article. And as I was saying earlier, cross-dressing it's a cultural thing, it's a lifestyle choice. We can't argue that this is a biological thing like, you know, being born with a black skin or being born with some serious problem like Tourette syndrome, or you know, which is an organic biological syndrome. It is a choice. It is a choice based on one's moral compass, on one's culture. And therefore, we have to decide as a society what is the moral compass and what is the culture we are trying to create. You can't just do that under the radar, under the guise of saying, oh, let's support diversity, when you're actually giving them suggestions. I mean, I accept that some people want to cross-dress, but a lot of people do a lot of things, right? We can't be using school time to suggest to kids all the kind of fringe, wacky things that they might do. You know, as much as we support freedom, that is not really, as I understand it, what schools are meant to be about. We're meant to be educating kids in certain basic important skills and knowledge to allow them to function in society. But these cultural practices, really, the main problem here, folks, is that the government is moving in to appropriate this space in society, and it is kind of pushing parents out of the picture. And as we've seen with Safe Schools Coalition, they were actually encouraging kids to get online and do stuff online without their parents knowing. And this is just so dangerous. I mean, you know, and I'm not accusing the organizers of in any way supporting this, but this could lead to kids getting online and being groomed. You know, this is what happens. And that's why parental involvement in what kids do is so important. And this just seems like a no-brainer to me. This just seems so obvious. Don't have an awful lot of time to talk about the rest of that today because I want to play to you a clip from Kevin Miller's movie. I'm actually not going to get into some of the other subjects I said I was going to talk about today. As usual, I've run out of time. I want to play to you a clip from Letters from Generation RX because we're going to be getting Kevin Miller on in the next hour and we'll be going into some of the detail. The film, I believe, is narrated by actress Tilda Swinton and it's really, really nicely produced. And I just want to play to you a little of that. And here we go. This is explaining a bit about the background of SSRI drugs and some of the issues. Here we go.
SSRIs are better known as antidepressants.
These are some symptoms of depression.
Psychiatric drugs like SSRIs have been defended with religious zeal by their believers and damned by others as some of the most dangerous drugs on the planet. Distinguishing truth from fiction has been a challenge, and this has placed the public in the unenviable position of deconstructing the scientific and medical dogma on their own in the midst of a 30-year social experiment. As director of the National Institutes of Mental Health, Thomas Insull has been at the center of a storm of contradictions about the use of these drugs.
So I think we have to be very humble about this right now because we've often been so self-congratulatory because we have, after all, many people feel made great strides. The numbers don't really support that.
Dr. Insull's candor is sure to shock and upset many on all sides of the debate. The word failure is one few have dared to utter.
Fundamentally, why have we failed here? Why has the suicide rate not come down? Why has the measures of disability, whatever those might be, why have those continued to go up instead of down?
I'm just going to pause it there, just so that you're aware that Thomas Insull is the former director of the National Institute of Mental Health. There is no higher respected authority on this than this man. He's no longer in that position. But the information you're getting here is coming from a source that is unimpeachable. And this is so important because a lot of the arguments that we have with people who are pro-psychiatric treatments, pro-SSRIs, take the angle that it is only from a fringe group, that it is only people who lack medical expertise that make these claims that the drugs are not as effective as mainstream media would have you believe. Well, this film by Kevin Miller really puts the lie to that. Just returning you to the clip now.
All the numbers are going in the wrong direction. So where have we failed? What's gone wrong here?
The answers, according to Insull, run contrary to the standard arguments put forth by mental health professionals.
A lot of people will say it's because of stigma and access. The fact is that actually more people are getting more treatment than ever before, so it's hard for me to quite believe that. I would just submit that from the NIMH perspective, the answer about why we failed is a little more disruptive, and that answer is that we don't know enough.
To hear the director of the NIMH say now that all of the exaltations about psychotropics from the media, from academia, from the profession, from governments, were not merited, is unsettling. After billions of prescriptions and hundreds of billions of dollars in drug company profits, how did this occur?
I think that our field has gone off track here by devoting so much of its resources over the last 20 or 30 years, both publicly and privately, to trying to understand how the drugs work. If the drugs were truly curative, if it was like trying to understand how insulin helps somebody with diabetes, that might be defensible. But you've got medications here that at most reduce some of the symptoms of mood disorders, of psychotic disorders. They don't in any sense provide a cure.
This change of heart contradicts what we've been told about psychiatric drugs for a generation now, and raises serious questions about how and why these drugs have been dispensed so indiscriminately to millions.
I was massively drugged. I tried drug after drug. I did what they told me to do. I used to take tranquilizers, benzodiazepines. That's all I did, was pop pills all day.
They just kept handing me pills, you know, here, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this. And I felt like a walking pharmaceutical company, really, and nothing was working. I was drugged out. I was a non-existent person. I mean, I was just, I had a heartbeat, and that's really all that I had.
I was just sort of given these pills and said, swallow this, take that, chew this. And I was never told, well, you might experience these side effects, or this actually might not work. It's sort of like they were just given to me as a universe, like a panacea, like this is going to fix your Tourette's, this is going to fix your OCD, this is going to fix everything, and everything's going to be all better. And I really, as an 8 and 9 year old, I really believed that until I began really experiencing all those horrible side effects, and that eventually changed me into not even a person, but like a monster. I was horrible.
Doctors, to a large degree, have abandoned their Hippocratic Oath, which is to do no harm. And that is, it's like a pill for every ill. They are knee-jerk prescribers, many of them. In fact, it's been shown that the average doctor will make a decision to prescribe a drug within 19 seconds of seeing a patient.
Using antidepressants or any of the psychiatric drugs is simply not, it's not understood, it's not explained, it's not dwelt upon. I think they're in a different class of drugs from most of the drugs that we take for our other ailments.
In the 80s and 90s, SSRIs were the first in a class of new mental health potions, heralded as wonder drugs and miracle cures. They were extolled as safe and effective solutions for the age-old problem of depression and were marketed as such.
Okay, that's all the time we have. I do recommend the film, and you will be able to buy it, and I think there's going to be a discount price for downloading it that Kevin is going to announce soon. So stay tuned for the next hour coming up with Kevin P. Miller, where we'll be talking about this film, and we'll be talking about a lot of issues that relate to it, some important questions that I've got about it. So don't go away, just stay right there. We'll be back after the news break at the second hour.